from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard Rodriguez brings a singular voice to a world of retweets and social media Me Toos. He writes about the life of a soul in the time of growing public atheism in America, about men and women and the evolution of their identities and roles, about Las Vegas and Jerusalem and Lance Armstrong and Cesar Chavez. This hour On Point, Richard Rodriguez on, well, life. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you read Rodriguez? What's your big question on life, sex, gender, color, God? For our big thinker, join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Later in this hour, we will go to the National Mall in Washington, D.C., and speak to one of those who is fasting there to push for immigration reform. But first, Richard Rodriguez, essayist and a fellow at New American Media, a nationwide collaboration of ethnic news media services. He's drawn attention again and again over the years for books such as Brown, The Last Discovery of America, Days of Obligation, An Argument with My Mexican Father, and Hunger of Memory. His new book, a collection of essays, is Darling, a Spiritual Autobiography. Richard Rodriguez, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Wonderful to hear your voice again.
Yeah, and yours too. I have to say, I read so much in this chair for this chair, and I just love reading you. What a wonderful, wide-ranging, and kind of untrammeled mind. You don't take anybody else's angle on where you're headed. You've got your own, and it's just terrific. These essays were such a pleasure. My respect, sir.
Thank you, Tom. It does occur to me sometimes that there is a madness to my writing, partly because I live so much apart from the writing community on the East Coast. I'm not a professional writer in my own mind, but I'm an observer constantly. And I'm listening to people and watching people. And these essays really, for me, are not essays in favor of an agenda or arguing a program. I'm really struck always by the complexity of our lives and by the density of our experience. So when I write about religion, I write about also my own disbelief, the fact that there are seasons of belief and unbelief in my own soul. When I write about the heroes of our society, I write also of them as human beings, as failures. It's toward that complexity that I'm always moving.
And it is some great movement. It makes me realize how much is not singularly considered, how often we put a kind of a cookie cutter on things, even when we don't think we're doing so. You know, I wonder if we could just go straight to the word that sits on the cover of this new collection, Darling. I mean, you've got, yes, there's religion and discussion of faith in here, and we'll look at that. There's a lot about gender as well, and they intersect quite interestingly. But I wish you'd just take us to this word. What took you to it? What took you to build such an interesting essay around it? It ends up taking us in all kinds of directions, to gender identity, to sexuality, maybe above all to women, which I didn't expect right off the bat, but what about this word, Richard?
Well, for one thing, I didn't want to write that essay. I shouldn't say that. The essay wrote me, but I thought originally I was going to write an essay on gays and marriage and my own relationship to another man now over 30 years long.
Yeah.
But as the essay developed, it became an essay about my relationship to heterosexual women, friends of mine, and my debt to women. I dedicate this book, after all, to the Sisters of Mercy, a Roman Catholic order of nuns that educated me. They were Irish women who came to California and educated me in the 1950s. Remarkable women. I would call them the first feminists of my life. But as I was writing this essay about a lunch I had with a friend of mine, now dead of cancer, maybe 15 years ago in Malibu, on the late afternoon of when her divorce was finalized, this essay began to assume a different character. It became about my debt to women, about the fact that women have in many ways liberated me, not simply as an American, although they've given me my American voice, not simply in the fact that I could understand my life best through them. My closest friends have always been women. But finally, although there is a kind of popular social history in America, centered in New York, that parochial or otherwise, that has always seen Stonewall as sort of the beginning of the gay identity movement. The riots around the Stonewall bar in Greenwich Village, the freedom of the night that the gays wanted. But what I began to see is that maybe my identity as a gay man owed more to the late 19th century, early 20th century suffragette movement of women wanting to vote, women getting out of the house, women leaving the parlor to go into the streets, to march in the streets, dressed very soberly, demanding the equality in the civic in their civic arena. That movement out of the kitchen, out of the parlor, I think predated my own movement out of the closet, in the sense that what these women wanted to do was in some way to transcend the role of mother, the role of wife, and to become in the ballot booth a singular person.
You track that arc of politics and gender identity, and it's funny because you start with this word, darling, which of course has its own sort of campy gay community connotations many times, but a lot more as well. And you follow that from that kind of beginning, you playing as a young man with your sister with the word, trying it on, you follow it right into the heart of the heterosexual family and this sort of reordering that's gone on there since the suffragettes. And then from that, right back out to Abrahamic religion and all the rest. Take us on some of that journey.
Well, I'm struck by the fact that Pope Francis recently said about the Catholic Church, my Catholic Church. I used to call myself Roman Catholic, but after I began to work on this book, I began to realize that Christians are not so much connected to Europe, to Rome or to Geneva or to the Germany or to Greece, but rather to the desert, the Middle Eastern deserts. And now I think of myself, and a brother to the Jew and the Muslim, as being, by virtue of my Christianity, having a desert faith in a desert God. Well, when Pope Francis said recently that, you know, that our church has been too preoccupied by gay marriage and abortion, he didn't say why. He didn't say what that preoccupation was. In my mind, the preoccupation was of the church was that we were not generative, that as our sexuality was not giving birth. It was, in the case of abortion, obviously, doing the reverse. In the case of gay marriage, here were people who were not giving birth to a new generation. The desert religions begin in this landscape of such desolation and with this imperative to give birth, for the identity of the person to be merged into the tribe, a tribe as numerous as the stars in the sky. With that imperative, it seems to me that what you have in the desert religions, particularly in the male cry in the night, is this dream of a son, is this dream of children, is this dream of generations to follow. What Pope Francis did not say, Jerry Falwell said immediately after September 11th, when he blamed a group of Americans for the calamity of September 11th, among them, he said, were feminists, abortionists, and gays. And there it was again, that same link between gays and feminists. And I thought to myself, I want to know what that is, to be of a world in which I do not have children, but I belong to a religion that has always prized the father more than the husband, the mother more than the wife. And how do I see myself in relationship to women in America now who are increasingly living without men in their lives and who are increasingly divorced? That became how the essay worked itself out.
Fascinating essay.
That's why the nuns are also there.
Yes, you say the church regards homosexual marriage as a travesty that will promote the undoing of marriage. But I propose, Richard Rodriguez writes here, the single mother is a greater threat to the patriarchal determination of what constitutes a natural order. And you describe this as sort of being the key that Man, like an awful lot of things. You say, I'm thinking of David Grossman, the Israeli novelist, who's been our guest here, who in a profile in New Yorker said, if God came to Sarah and told her, give me your son, your only one, your beloved Isaac, she, as a single mother, would tell him, give me a break.
Yes, and you can just hear her, too. You know, that this child that she loves, this child that she protects, God wants him. God wants to take him. And it is, I think, the feminine impulse in that instance, the maternal instinct would be to protect him from God.
And yet that's an instinct toward life. The church says it is protecting life in its stance on this. And you know people who very earnestly say that and would say it to you right now. Come on, Richard. We're trying to protect life. Isn't that the heart of it?
Well, I don't doubt the impulse. That is, it seems to me the church is life-giving. It gave me a great deal in my life. But it seems to me that it doesn't quite understand that the deepest problem in the Abrahamic religions, the problem of the desert, is that it announces too much the God, the life-giver, as being the male principle. Unless we can imagine somehow that what we call God is, that what we call Father is also a woman, indistinguishable in authority and creative presence, I think we're always going to run into this problem, that the male stands in favor of life, the convention says. When I say it, the woman also stands in favor of life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with gay, Christian, essayist Richard Rodriguez, the most empathetic essayist in America, he's been called, really talking about life. He writes in Darling, we were just on this, he says, I cannot imagine my freedom as a homosexual man without women, women in veils, women in red Chanel, women in flannel nightgowns, women in their mirrors, women saying, honey bunny, women saying, we'll see, women saying, if you lay one hand on that child, I swear to God, I will kill you, women in curlers, women in high heels, younger sisters, older sisters, women and girls. Without women, he can't imagine his own life. He joins us from San Francisco. Jill is calling from New Haven, Connecticut. Jill, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Richard. I actually want to go back to Hunger of Memory, which I read probably when it first came
1990
out.
1990 that came out, yes.
Oh, I thought I read it much earlier than
okay.
that.
But, it was actually 1982.
Was very, sorry.
I'm sorry?
Sorry, 82, sorry.
Yeah, no, I that's good. And I was a bilingual educator, and still am, in the world of languages. And I was very, very moved by the idea of heart language and home language and the separation from academic language or out in the world language and how, you know, it put a wedge, I sensed a wedge between you and your family. And
yeah.
Very moved by it and found working with adolescents who are bilingual and still do that, you know, it's a growing concern. But for people who don't know the other language, Spanish, for example, which is what I know, also is, explaining, you know, to them that, people are literate and they're thinking and et cetera, but, you know, in another language, and the separation goes on when the kids, don't respond to their parents in the first language, the only language that the parents may know. But it was very moving, and I'm still finding it. It's on my shelf still.
Hunger of Memory, 1982. Thank you, Joe.
Yeah. It does seem to me, Tom, that struggle goes on in America. I notice that Hispanics continue with the difficulty of public language. And we educators think, well, if we talk to children in Spanish in the classroom, we'll solve the problem. Well, we don't solve the problem because the difficulty for children is to learn to speak differently in the classroom. It's not technically a different language. It's a different intention that when you speak to a stranger, you speak differently. When you speak to someone who is within the house, you speak intimately. Mm. So the child is being ideally, moving between a home with luxurious voices assuring him of his separation mm-hmm. from the general society and the classroom, where the instruction is to speak up, to speak to the stranger, not to one person, but to all the boys and girls. That journey is very difficult for children who grow up with intense private lives. And
across the language line.
Exactly. But across a social line. Mm-hmm. I have a friend of mine who went to Bryn Mawr College mm-hmm. a number of years ago, an African-American woman, who remembers going home to South Carolina one summer and her mother standing at the screen door to greet her at the beginning of summer, and her mother saying to her, "I don't want you speaking white in here." That instruction from a parent not to speak.
Not just English.
Not to speak. It's not English. Mm-hmm. Not to speak in the voice of the stranger, and not to speak with the presumption of the middle-class voice, mm-hmm. not to speak with the assurance of the middle-class mm-hmm. voice. "I don't want you bringing that into the house," you know. Many children have to struggle within this drama of two audiences. It's not two languages. It's two ways of being.
Where are we on that? It's 30 years more since you came out with A Hunger of Memory. You've had Days of Obligation, Argument with My Mexican Father since then, Brown since then. We're going to talk later in this hour with one of those on the mall in Washington, the National Mall, who's on a hunger strike for immigration reform. But what about the fundamental dynamic of the integration that's underway and not?
I think many working class children, and I would include Appalachian white children, mm-hmm. I'd include African Americans, many working class children have not made that transition in the classroom to a public language. Increasingly, I'm meeting middle class students who spend a lot of time digitally using language, but increasingly they have lost the gift, the knowledge, the imperative of using language publicly. I was at Columbia University recently teaching a writing class, and a woman wrote an essay, a graduate student, a wonderful essay about getting an abortion. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, you know, there's something so mechanical about this essay. It doesn't have a sense of the shocking quality of the event." She said, "Well, for people of my generation," she said, "it's not a shocking event." And I thought, well, you know, if you're going to be a writer, you better realize that there are people to whom you are writing. This is the sense of an audience who find abortion abhorrent. In other words, you have to move in writing from a sense of your own perspective to a sense of the stranger. What does the stranger understand? As I'm sitting here using the stranger's language, my intention is not simply to express my own ideas, but is to make myself clear to the other. If I fail as a writer, it is not simply that I have not made myself clear to myself, but I've not made myself clear to the other. That's what public language is.
You're saying something. Do I hear you saying that, A, you're for bilingual education, but B, that there's something missing even in our mainstream English language use now that's cutting us off from that language of civil society to fully convey in a public setting intimacy, accuracy?
What I'm saying is that I'm in favor of children knowing as many languages as possible in their lives. But for many children, the drama of the classroom has been a failure because they do not learn in the classroom to learn to speak to the stranger, to learn to write for the stranger, to use language not for oneself, but for the other. Yeah. And at that point, it seems to me, we have lost the meaning of public school. We have lost the meaning of grammar school. These terms we used to use so routinely have become mysterious to us. The classroom is not about teaching me to become Mexican. The classroom is teaching me about, in some way, not to be Mexican, but to be an American student, to speak to people who aren't Mexican. If I fail in that, then I have failed the central lesson of education.
Richard Rodriguez writes about language, about the life, social and private, and religious and gender in his new book, Darling, A Spiritual Autobiography. He writes about family structure and women there. He writes, "The prospect of a generation of American children being raised by women in homes without fathers is challenging for religious institutions whose central conception of deity is father, whose central conception of church is family, whose only conception of family is heterosexual. A woman who can do without a husband can do without any patriarchal authority." His knife of language cuts deep. Julia in Spokane, Washington, thank you for calling. Julia, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Richard. Thank you, Julia, so much for this. Thank you for this wonderful talk. I regret that I didn't hear it from the beginning. I jumped in right when you were talking about the Abrahamic religions and how they are not meeting the needs of today's modern women. And I was completely inspired by that. That resonated so deeply because I am the leader, for lack of a better word, of a group of women who are seeking spirituality outside of the patriarchal system that we all have been indoctrinated in, introduced in, and have adopted, but it doesn't fit. And as you were saying, Richard, you know, women are divorced. Women are having children without men. There are lesbian women who are having families. All of these women are part of the circle that I have been leading for the past year, and it is incredible to see the conflict that arises as they are having to uncondition their minds away from this father figure God, this very male-oriented God, to something that is more goddess, something that feels more with greater equanimity, something that relates to them, something that reflects who they are in this modern society as caregivers, providers, the breadwinners, so on and so forth. And so I really see an incredible movement that is insecure and at the same time empowered. So I just want to thank you. I cannot wait to read your book.
Thank you, Julia, very much. That is what I hear too, Tom. I mean, I'm quite aware of the noisiness in our public discussion of the new atheism, for example. Mm. Christopher Hitchens, who used to come on shows like this a lot,
sure,
to tell us that God is not great, a deliberate offense to Islam, at the same time that he was also arguing in favor of the war in Iraq, that the British lines in the sand shall stand, you know. But it seemed to me that what we're not noticing is in this preoccupation with the growing atheism is the reconstruction of religion by women in this country. I don't think women are becoming atheists so much as they are reimagining Godhead, as Julia was suggesting, and that's why I you know, when I write that that we have to understand Abba, we have to understand God as not simply male. The male does not by himself give life. The male and the female give life. And to somehow give the generative impulse of the world to the male, I think, and to ignore the female within God, I think is the deepest problem.
What are the implications of that? First for religion and secondly, if you do unlock the patriarchal and you say, look, all these households headed by women across this country, and it's a huge percentage at this point, they're like a standing challenge to the patriarchal because there's no patriarch there. If you unlock the patriarchal, what are the implications for religion? Abrahamic is where you come from. What are the implications, the social implications of that?
One of the happiest implications is that what's clear to me right now is that these male-ordered religions are in chaos.
But this is your religion too, and you embrace it.
They are fighting each other. They the world could end very soon with a prayer. I was struck on September 11th with the fact that those men in those 757 jets that were headed toward the World Trade Center and to the Pentagon, they were praying at the end, and it reminded me of just how potent and how dangerous and how deadly religion can be. At the same time, it seems to me, and this is my hope.
And not just 9/11, if I may, only yesterday when all that nuclear stuff disappeared in Mexico, and I was thinking, where's that going to show up when it was gone? But anyway, I interrupt you, sorry.
Not only yesterday, but every day there's catastrophe in the world, and a lot of it is religious catastrophe, or at least catastrophe that pretends to be religious. I believe, having traveled through the Middle East now for several years, that this war between the Shia and the Sunni is not a theological war. It becomes a tribal war led by chieftains who, for their own purposes of power, use religion. But let that pass. It seems to me that we are at a point in the history of certainly the Abrahamic religions when the male ordering of those religions is coming to a halt. And if the churches are reconstructed, it seems to me more along the lines of Julia was suggesting, and the admission of she into the notion of the God, and the implications for that are widespread. But they're already here. I mean, that so many American boys are being raised in families without fathers.
What are the implications? How do they ripple out?
Young boys are used to the idea of strong mothers. A lot of people say, well, your mother must have been a very strong woman. That's why you're a gay man. As though somehow being a strong woman creates the effeminacy in the male. I think just the reverse. I think my strength, the strength of my voice, the strength of my opinion, the willingness to stand in America and to argue and to observe publicly comes as much from my mother as it does from my father. And that in some way, you know, my mother would be very proud of the fact that she has enabled me with her strength. That's the change that we are seeing now. I think that if there's a sociology of religion that is emerging, it's a sociology that's coming out of the family, where increasingly boys and girls are being raised within, what shall we say, an organization of the kitchen in which the mother is both mother and father.
And yet you perplex me in this. You're so wonderful at laying out how you're looking at the world, and there you've described kind of unlocking of the patriarchal lockbox, but at the same time, you're in a church that is deeply, you're in a faith continent, Abrahamic, that's deeply patriarchal. You write, why do I stay in the Catholic Church? Q. A. I stay in the church because the church is more than its ignorance. The church gives me more than it denies me. I stay in the church because it is mine.
Stop there, Tom. Well, I stay in the church because it is mine. I believe that. I believe that it is not that the church belongs to me as much as it belongs to the Pope, and that I change the church within the church. The church is an evolutionary institution. It changes over time.
The admission of she in a patriarchal religious continent, is it still the church?
Well, it seems to me at a point in which so many friends of mine who are nuns are dissatisfied with the male order, so many women in the pews are dissatisfied with the male order, I think we are already here. I think in some sense we have to use the past tense. This is what's been happening in the last few years, you know. And increasingly, you know, the launching for this book, Darling, came at an Episcopal cathedral here in San Francisco, Grace Cathedral, and I was interviewed by the dean, who is a woman. Then I was in New York at Union Theological Seminary, the preeminent liberal Protestant seminary in America, and I was interviewed by the president, who is a woman. It is already here.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with essayist Richard Rodriguez. Gay, Catholic, Hispanic. He's been called the most empathetic essayist in America. Really talking about life. He's with us from San Francisco today. What a pleasure. Kara's calling from Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Kara, you're on with Richard Rodriguez.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling as a fan of the show and of the essayist who's on currently. My question is, I'm a feminist attending a Jesuit university, and I'd really like the guest to speak more towards how Catholicism can bring in women, bring in the whole woman to the faith, and not just discourage women from the faith based on simply their modern thoughts.
Well, can I say, Kara, I think that you already are doing that. I mean, your presence within a Jesuit institution already is the change. But I should say within our church, two things about the Roman Church. One is the importance of the Virgin Mary to Catholics, almost to the point of where many Protestants have accused us of a Mariology, of creating a goddess in Mary. And it is certainly the case in many cultures of the world, Mexico being one of them, where you will see the Virgin Mary in her altar more prominently visited by men and women than images of Christ or God the Father. That already begins something. In dedicating this book to the Sisters of Mercy, I was struck in the 19th century by the fact that the church, the male church, the bishops, began to allow women a public life in advance of housewives and other women in the society. I mean, in Europe, women were allowed to join religious orders and go into the public to run hospitals, to run schools. And you began to see them doing things that women previously had not done, living without men. They did so dressed like Muslim women in burqas, essentially. The women who educated me in the 1950s wore black. You never saw their arms. You never saw their hair. They were, but in some way, their clothing was a protection. It allowed them to move easily in a world of men. That was the beginning of something that I think our mothers took the example of. They were a generation certainly before people like my mother, people who didn't have the education that they had, were not running hospitals and orphanages and schools. And now the religious orders are in decline numerically, but that's only because women like Kara will take the responsibility of that public life. But in previous to the 19th century, women didn't wander the streets and run hospitals and schools the way they began to do. They came to San Francisco, for the Sisters of Mercy, for example, and they were regarded as whores by anti-Catholic newspapers in this town. They set up tent hospitals in this town. They ministered to young men who had been minors in the gold rush and who were suffering from the smallpox epidemic. They opened up schools for children. This was unprecedented. And they were at least a generation, two, three generations ahead of secular women. But this was the beginning of something that I think is important for us to recognize. You know, I'm struck even now with all this talk of gay marriage that we don't have a language, we homosexuals don't have a language as revolutionary as Ms. When feminists came up in the 1960s with Ms., which was neither one nor the other, and told you neither that I was married or unmarried, had children or didn't have children. Ms. was a new word. I don't have a language for what I am with my. I was going to say partner, but we're not a law firm. He's not my bride. He's not my husband. We're in lack of a vocabulary, and in some way, we're still looking for the model of the feminist to help us out of this linguistic, what shall I say? We're stalled linguistically. Mm. We don't have a way of imagining marriage except as marriage. Maybe it's not marriage that I want. Maybe it's a union that doesn't use that heterosexual word.
Boy, a lot of people fought for that. A lot of people piling in there, gay people piling in there right now. I'm not sure where their heads are turning. Kara, thanks and good luck. James in Nashville, Tennessee. James, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. You're welcome. I have a lot of things to say. This has brought up a lot of things in my mind, but I think the most important thing is this idea that the women are, doing the things that they haven't had to do before. Mm-hmm. For example, the example Mr. Rodriguez is using is raising children on their own. I think you can look at a much easier, something that's a lot easier to look at, and it's in the churches. For example, during a meal or some outreach, the women are the ones doing the work. They're always, I mean, you can go into any church, into any kind of outreach or anything like that, and the women are primarily the ones doing the work. The men are sitting on the side with their legs crossed and not really doing anything.
What if they become the leaders, the voice, the face of faith?
That's exactly my point. That's it, and the other thing about this is it sounds like, I'm not sure, I might be misinterpreting what he's saying, mm-hmm. but it sounds like Mr. Rodriguez is saying that this is a good thing, and it's not.
Why?
Because in the Abrahamic, to use his term, the Abrahamic religions, Christianity specifically, men were given one role and women were given another role, and the men were given the role of leader. And I believe that that's what the church teaches. So if you believe, if you are a Christian and that's what you believe, and you see that deteriorating, that is not a good thing.
Because it's not your reading of the Bible, or because you think it will somehow harm the way we live? Why exactly, James?
Because I think that there's a natural order of things. And one of the orders that's been set up by the Abrahamic religions, by God himself, by our Creator, and I have to say quickly here that I do believe that God is both male and female. I honestly believe that. I've actually had an experience in that. But without going into that, I believe that that's the way the order has been set up. Men were set up as leaders, and they are not doing their job. They're
James, let us take it right there. We've only got a couple of more minutes before we go to the National Mall in Washington and a hunger striker there on the immigration reform front. But holy cow, Richard, we've got a lot on the table before then. You're upsetting the natural order, the cosmos upside down when you change this role.
If James acknowledges that God is female and male, the natural order already is established in that admission, and that in some way we have disordered things by making only the male the governor of the house. Clearly, the male has failed. I think James and I would agree with that.
What do you mean when you say that?
I think
the fallen world is all the male's fault, really?
No, I don't think it's all the male's fault. But mm-hmm. I do think that there is some, what shall I say, a kind of obliviousness in the way families are being organized that men give birth and then wander away. I mean, I know a number of good male friends who were essentially abandoned by their fathers. That's a failure to me. And and they were raised in two instances by grandmothers and in other instances by mothers, solely by mothers. Now this is an extraordinary failure, and then to have to go to church and listen to a God who is described only as father and not as mother seems to me a failure. As you go to the Washington Mall, can I just say one last thing?
Yes, of course.
It seems to me that the catastrophe for the left right now in America is that we have conceded, because of these sexual issues, feminism and gay identity, we've conceded religion to the right, because we turned the left into a sexual liberation movement, and increasingly we have forgotten the great lessons that I was raised with, the Black Civil Rights Movement, for example, when Martin Luther King Jr. in Washington gave the speech at the Lincoln Memorial. That was a sermon he gave us about the mountaintop. It was biblical. And America once acknowledged that. Cesar Chavez going on a hunger strike, that was a religious movement as much as it was a secular movement. And we are seeing it again in Washington right now. We are seeing people who are as much religiously inclined as they are making a political point.
Richard Rodriguez, you come at the world from an angle so wonderfully untrammeled. You really make us think, and we are grateful for that. Thank you so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
The new book is Darling, A Spiritual Autobiography by Richard Rodriguez. In a moment, we go to the National Mall in Washington to talk with one of the people fasting there for immigration reform. This is On Point. On November 12th, seven activists operating under the banner Fast for Families began a fast to push the cause of comprehensive immigration reform. They've been joined by others since on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. and around the country. The President and First Lady, the Vice President, and members of Congress from both parties have visited them in their tent on the Mall. Chicago community activist Rudy Lopez joined them 15 days ago and is still at it. Rudy Lopez joins me now from the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Rudy Lopez, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Let us picture what's going on there. First of all, what's the weather on the Mall today, Rudy?
It's actually really beautiful. The sun is out. The temperature has gotten really nice, and it's a really beautiful day here.
Are you in the tent or outside under the sun?
I'm in the tent. This has been our home for the last 24, 25 days now. And as you noted, I've been here fasting now on my 15th day.
And where have you pitched your tent there on the mall? Are you near the Washington Monument or the Vietnam Memorial? Where are you?
We're right across from the Capitol.
Okay.
Right on 3rd Street between Jefferson and Madison. And you know, I want to make sure people get a sense. It's a tent, not necessarily like a camping tent, mm-hmm. more so like a sort of tent structure. So we have a community area where every night at 6 p.m. we have a community meeting where people are welcome to come by. And then we have a tent with our medical staff that continue to monitor us regularly and do a great job of doing that. And then we have a tent for the fasters themselves that they're in a quiet area where they can rest because, as you can imagine, we want to conserve as much of our energy as possible.
Now, Rudy, you've been fasting for 15 days, but I don't hear starvation in your voice. What kind of fast is this?
It's a water-only fast. I've consumed no food and have been on water.
Really? Literally for 15 days? You sound pretty good, Rudy. You're good at this.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, it's amazing how the body goes through a transformation. I actually feel better than I did the first week. The body goes through some withdrawal over the first several days, and you have intense hunger pains and really intense headaches as well. But as your body goes through that, you begin to go into a different stage where it begins to just try to get as much energy as possible. Now that I'm going into my third week, it's gotten to a point where it's really trying to conserve as much energy as possible, and I still have the hunger. In fact, it's gone from sharp sort of pains that come in waves to really constant, but it's more like a dull hunger that I now have as my constant companion. I feel weaker. I move a little slower. I speak a little softer. My body is deteriorating, but my spirit has never been so full, and the atmosphere here at the tent and the support we've gotten, and more than anything, the reason we're here is what's given me the strength to continue.
A person cannot fast forever. Are you any closer to immigration reform? It doesn't seem to be in the cards anytime soon.
Well, we believe that we've made a great difference, and I think the results of our efforts have shown that. One of the main reasons that we wanted to be here is, number one, be able to raise awareness about the suffering that's happened as a result of our broken immigration system. I myself, not an immigrant, but grew up in an immigrant household, have seen the pain and the toll it takes on the human condition when that happens. My house has been a port of entry for several of my relatives who have come here undocumented, and I've seen the pain it causes when they can't be there for the birth of their children, or they can't return to bury a loved one. That changes a person. And in 2005, I lost a cousin who came to this country looking for a better life for his family. And he hired a coyote, a human smuggler, like so many do. And with the group as they passed, he got sick, and he was abandoned by the coyote. And he was left with two things. He was left with a gallon of water and a promise that they would return for him, a promise they didn't keep. My cousin Martin Hernandez, he died in that desert. He died hungry, cold, and alone. And over 400 people a year share that same fate, an unnecessary, a senseless fate. And that's why we're here, being able to, in our small way, through our sacrifice, be able to give light to the much greater sacrifice that people make every day and the millions across the country who are in suffering right now.
You know, there is resistance to this reform, and it comes from people from a couple of angles. Maybe they think we don't want the culture to change so much in that direction. Maybe they think this isn't good for American workers. It undercuts their wages, their economic standing.
I'm glad you raised that. One of the things I think it's important for people to know is that we love this country very much. I'm an American, and I'm proud of that. And we have this tent full of Americans and aspiring Americans. And we want America to live up to its rich history, its rich immigrant history, because we believe that that's what made this country great. So the reason that we're doing this is really to be able to add to this country in positive ways. Now, we know that there's opposition, and I think that most polling will show, and polling all across the country has shown, that the American public by far is with us. The voices of opposition are getting drowned out more and more every day, and there's a good reason why. All different sectors of our society have shown how this could really be a great benefit from an economic standpoint, even a cultural enhancement. I mean, what's made this country great is really the welcoming and gathering of different people from all over the world. And, you know, it's important that people understand that this is not just about people that are coming from Latin America or from Mexico, but really how we're welcoming people from all over.
Rudy Lopez is in the 15th day of a fast there in the National Mall in Washington, D.C., with Fast for Families, Fasting for Comprehensive Immigration Reform. Mr. Lopez, stay warm and good luck. Thank you for joining us. This is On Point.